On a warm morning in July 1920, the crowd outside 27 School Street in Boston pressed shoulder to shoulder. People clutched stamped receipts and small notebooks as they waited for the doors of the Securities Exchange Company to open. Some whispered about the chance to double their money in 45 days. Others came only to withdraw, uneasy about rumors spreading through the city. Officers watched the line grow down the block. Inside, Charles Ponzi stood behind his desk and adjusted his tie. He said the rush meant people believed in him. His assistants tried to keep order as investors demanded answers. The company had never moved this much cash in one morning. The question whispered in the crowd traveled up the stairs. Was Ponzi's promise real, or was this the beginning of something breaking? No one knew it yet, but the day held the first visible sign that the structure could not hold. Chapter 1, The Promise. The crowd outside 27 School Street thickened as the sun climbed over Boston. It was July 1920, and people pressed close to the brick building with folded receipts in their hands. They had shown up early because Charles Ponzi told them they would see 50% returns in 45 days. Some said they had already doubled their savings once. Others were here for the first time, pulled in by excited neighbors. The street felt charged. Each person in the line believed they stood at the edge of a chance that did not come often. Inside the office, clerks moved quickly between wooden desks stacked with envelopes and tall ledger books. They opened cash drawers and counted fresh bills delivered earlier that morning. Pens scratched on paper as they prepared for another heavy day. They had worked past midnight the night before and were back again before sunrise. No one complained. They knew the company was growing at a speed that felt unreal. Ponzi walked among them and looked over their shoulders. He told them to stay calm. He said people were coming because the system worked. Before this moment, Charles Ponzi had been a man who lived through near constant frustration. He arrived in America in 1903 with $2.50 in his pocket. He stepped off the ship in Boston Harbor and tried to push his way into opportunity. He wanted to fit in. He struggled with the language. He worked odd jobs. He faced employers who did not trust a new immigrant. He drifted down the East Coast, then to Montreal, then back to the United States. He talked his way into office roles, sales jobs, and small ventures that failed. At times, he was arrested for minor financial offenses. When he thought about his future, he pictured himself rising above the people who had dismissed him. He dreamed of becoming someone whose name meant power. In 1919, Ponzi encountered something that changed his direction. It started as a simple question about international postal reply coupons. A letter from a business contact in Spain used one of the coupons. The coupon could be exchanged for a stamp in the United States. Ponzi stared at it and wondered whether price differences between countries could create a chance for profit. He studied currency tables and compared the cost of the coupons across Europe. If he bought coupons in one country where they were cheap and redeemed them in the United States where they were worth more, the margin looked large. He believed he could turn that margin into a fortune. He spent nights calculating the numbers at a small kitchen table. He wrote figures again and again, convinced he had found a hidden corner of the world that others overlooked. He began telling friends he had discovered a guaranteed return. He said governments could not stop it because postal treaties had fixed prices. When he explained the plan, he spoke with certainty. He said the profit was baked into the system. When his friends hesitated, he told them he understood risk better than anyone. He said this was the safest thing he had ever seen. By early 1920, Ponzi opened his company. He called it the Securities Exchange Company. He rented space on School Street and placed an ad calling for investors. He said he would pay them 50% in 45 days or 100% in 90 days. People read the offer and said it could not be real. Yet a few curious men walked up the narrow stairs and listened. Ponzi greeted them with a warm smile. He spoke about the postal treaty rules. He showed them the coupon. He promised he would handle everything. They only needed to invest. Some of the earliest investors were Italian immigrants who saw themselves in Ponzi. He spoke their language. He knew their struggles. He said he wanted to help them build savings the country denied them. They trusted him because he felt familiar. They trusted him because he looked like one of their own who had made it. They returned with neighbors and cousins. Soon the office felt like a gathering place for people hoping for a better life. When the first group received their payouts, word spread fast. Men said Ponzi delivered exactly what he promised. Women told friends that he paid early. The idea that money could grow at this speed spread through coffee shops, street corners, and small grocery stores. People said they had found the one person who understood how to work the system. They crowded the stairs and asked for receipts. They handed over savings meant for weddings, repairs, and new homes. Some withdrew money from banks to invest more. They said banks never offered this kind of return. They said Ponzi believed in the little man. By spring, Ponzi hired more clerks and rented more space. He added desks, typewriters, and stacks of printed forms. He directed men to carry bags of cash to nearby vaults. He sent runners to deliver receipts across the city. Each day felt like another step toward a fortune he believed he deserved. He told reporters the coupon system was the greatest discovery of his life. He said he had found something honest and simple. He said he was building a financial engine that worked for regular people rather than the wealthy. Boston watched him rise. People lined up outside the building before dawn. They formed crowds so thick that police were sent to keep order. The excitement outside made the city feel different. Some said the future had arrived. Some said it was a miracle. Others shook their heads. They felt uneasy about a return that high. They whispered that no one doubled their money without paying some hidden price. Inside banks, managers studied the math and frowned. They calculated how many postal reply coupons would be needed to produce the profit Ponzi claimed. The number reached into the millions. They said no one could move that many coupons. They said no country even printed that many. They worried that the city was sliding into danger. A few reached out quietly to state officials. They said someone should take a closer look before the situation spun out of control. In newsrooms, editors debated whether to assign reporters to Ponzi. Some feared attacking him would provoke backlash. Others said the job of a newspaper was to examine stories that grew too large. They listened to rumors from investors who claimed to know nothing about the coupon trade. They read letters from readers asking how Ponzi did it. The questions grew louder. The editors said they needed facts before they published anything. Ponzi continued to push ahead. He bought a larger home in Lexington. He drove new cars. He walked through his office with confidence. Clerks watched him move around the desks like a man who understood every detail of the system. He reminded them that they were helping people escape poverty. He said success required belief. When he saw fear in their faces, he told them to trust him. He said he had everything under control. The summer heat rose over Boston. More people crowded School Street each week. They held receipts in damp hands. Some wanted to invest. Some wanted to withdraw. Some wanted answers. Rumors swirled that officials were looking into the numbers. Investors wondered if they should pull their money now or wait for another payout. Parents brought their adult children to show them the opportunity. Elderly men arrived with life savings folded inside envelopes. Each day, the line stretched farther. Inside the office, clerks struggled to keep pace with the new wave of activity. They counted cash, stamped receipts, and answered questions with rehearsed lines. Ponzi moved among them, smiling at investors and reassuring them. He said the company was stronger than ever. He said they would see the future unfolding with their own eyes. He stepped behind his desk and signed withdrawal slips as quickly as he signed investment forms. For Ponzi, the moment felt triumphant. He believed he had found a way to finally rise above the failures of his past. He thought he had outsmarted the world that once turned him away. He did not show the strain of the growing crowds. He told himself the system still worked. He told himself the pressure outside only proved people trusted him. But a question pressed through the noise. Could Ponzi truly meet the returns he promised when so many people were now depending on him? Investors who studied the numbers wondered if the expansion was sustainable. Clerks whispered late at night that the withdrawals were coming too fast. Bankers met privately and asked how long the company could operate at this speed. Editors told reporters to gather everything they could find. The tension outside carried through the windows and into the office. Each footstep on the stairs grew heavier. Each voice carried more urgency. By mid-July, the line extended around the corner. People waited for hours. They talked about rumors of fire inspectors, auditors, and bankers. The pressure mounted with every new face. Ponzi looked out at the street from his window and saw the signs. The city's excitement was shifting. Trust was reshaping itself into something sharper. He still believed he could push forward. He still believed his vision would carry him through. But a new question began to rise behind every whisper in the crowd. Was the promise real, or was the structure already starting to strain? The question waited at the center of the growing line. It pushed up the stairs and pressed against the office door. It was the question that would decide everything about what came next. Chapter 2, Cracks in the Structure. The summer heat settled thick over Boston as the crowds around 27 School Street grew by the day. People lined the sidewalk before sunrise with receipts tucked in their pockets. They said Charles Ponzi had changed their lives. Some said they were planning to invest again because the returns came exactly when he promised. Others returned because they wanted to pull out while the rumors still felt uncertain. The air outside the office carried a mix of excitement and worry. The tension in the line shifted from day to day. Inside the building, the pace drove the clerks to the edge. They arrived early each morning and stacked envelopes across their desks. They checked ledgers, counted cash, and waited for Ponzi to arrive. Some of them watched the line forming outside and exchanged nervous glances. They knew the withdrawals were rising. They also knew the company was still paying out. They repeated Ponzi's promise to themselves. They said the system worked because it had always worked. As money continued to flood in, Ponzi moved through the office with confidence. He told his staff they were making history. He said the opportunity he discovered was only getting stronger. He spent more time meeting investors and posing for photographs. His suits grew sharper. His watch glimmered as he lifted his hand to shake another investor's grip. He believed the world had finally recognized his brilliance. He also believed the danger was smaller than it looked. But outside the company's walls, people who studied finance began to speak louder. They stepped back from the excitement and focused on the math behind Ponzi's promise. If the profits came from international postal reply coupons, they asked how many coupons were needed to match the millions flowing through the office. They used the numbers published by governments and postal authorities. They reached a conclusion they could not ignore. The scale was impossible. One financial expert said the company would need to process more coupons than existed across Europe. Another said that even if Ponzi bought every coupon from every post office in multiple countries, the profit would still fall far short of the returns he paid daily. These concerns spread through quiet circles in the financial district. Some bankers feared that Boston stood on unstable ground. They contacted regulators and asked for a closer look at the company's accounts. In newsroom offices across the city, editors sharpened their attention. The Boston Post became the center of the brewing storm. Reporters brought clippings to the managing editor's desk. They cited the enormous sums moving through Ponzi's hands. They asked why no one had verified his claims about the coupon trade. The managing editor listened to their questions. He tapped his pen against the edge of his desk. The story was growing too large to ignore. Inside one of the paper's small editorial rooms, a group of reporters argued their way through the facts. Some said Ponzi was a hero to working people. They worried that challenging him would draw their anger. Others said the numbers made no sense and that people deserved the truth. They reminded each other that the paper had a duty to expose instability when it threatened the public. The debate stretched late into the evening until the editor made a decision. They would investigate Ponzi. The first reporter assigned to the story gathered every document he could find. He examined Ponzi's early advertisements. He interviewed bankers who said the math could not work. He visited the post office to ask how reply coupons functioned. He returned with a stack of notes that left the editor speechless. The system Ponzi claimed to use appeared to be no more than a thin thread. The reporter said it was only a matter of time before something broke. The editor told him to keep digging. At the same time, state banking officials opened their own quiet inquiry. They asked for information from banks that handled Ponzi's deposits. They reviewed the company's balance sheets and tried to trace the coupon transactions. They found no large coupon purchases. They saw accounts that moved enormous sums each day with little explanation. They whispered that the structure began and ended with cash. They wondered how long it could continue. The lines outside the office grew heavier as these investigations quietly expanded. Investors grew restless. Some said they heard that bankers were getting too involved. Others said the Boston Post planned to publish something negative. A few insisted the rumors came from jealous people who wanted to bring Ponzi down. The arguments carried through the line each morning. The disagreement fed new levels of anxiety. Inside, Ponzi prepared for another morning rush. He adjusted his tie and smoothed the front of his jacket. He stepped behind his desk with the same confidence he had shown for months. When investors questioned him about the rumors, he waved them off. He said people attacked success when they could not understand it. He told them he had faced struggle all his life and would not let this distract him. They believed him because he spoke with calm certainty. But something around the edges began to shift. The Boston Post was now moving faster. Reporters approached Ponzi and asked for clarification on the coupon scheme. He dismissed their questions and accused them of stirring trouble. When the paper finally published its first article questioning the operation, the city paused. The headline cast doubt on the company's ability to deliver what it promised. People read the article in barbershops, cafes, and streetcars. Investors came to the office the next morning with fresh worry in their eyes. The crowd pushed against the doors more aggressively than before. Some demanded returns, some demanded explanations. Police watched the tension rise. Clerks struggled to calm the room. The withdrawals that day hit a level they had never seen. Ponzi answered questions with a steady voice. He said the paper was wrong. He said the investigation would clear him. He offered coffee to calm anxious investors. His charm seemed to soothe some, but not all. Behind the scenes, officials continued pressing for answers. They worked through bank statements and checked sources. They tracked the money flowing in and out of the company. They noticed patterns that deepened their concern. They did not see the coupon transactions that Ponzi claimed were the heart of the operation. They saw rapid deposits followed by rapid withdrawals. They saw millions moving with no clear economic activity behind it. Investors began returning at a higher rate. People whispered in the line that the Boston Post might publish more articles. They said authorities were looking into Ponzi's accounts. Some pulled out everything they had. Others reinvested, determined to hold on to the dream. Couples argued in hushed voices about whether to trust Ponzi or protect their savings. The tension in the line turned into pressure inside the office. As the newspaper pushed forward with additional reporting, the story intensified. Reporters spoke with postal officials who said the coupon trade could not generate the profits Ponzi described. They spoke with economists who said the system was mathematically impossible. They tracked Ponzi's past and uncovered parts of his history he had tried to leave behind. They found records of earlier ventures that collapsed. They found clues that Ponzi had always walked close to the edge. When the next article came out, the city reacted instantly. Investors crowded the office earlier than usual. Some ran up the stairs, shouting questions. The clerks struggled to keep order. Ponzi raised his hands and told them to calm down. He paid out withdrawals in full to prove the company was sound. People watched him sign receipt after receipt. Some relaxed when they saw the cash. Others grew more afraid, wondering how long this level of payout could continue. Rumors spread faster than facts. The public conversation moved from curiosity to alarm. Investors who had once praised Ponzi now questioned him openly. They asked why he avoided explaining the coupon trade in detail. They asked why the newspapers seemed to know more than the company itself revealed. The uncertainty became a force of its own. Bank officials met in private rooms and said the pressure could not continue. They believed the company faced a liquidity crisis. They worried that if the city panicked further, the situation would spiral. They reached out to state officials, who decided the time had come for a deeper look. In the office, Ponzi sensed the shift. He watched as clerks struggled to manage the wave of withdrawals. He listened to angry voices rising from the line. He kept telling himself the storm would pass. He believed he could talk his way through the doubt. He believed the strength of his personality and the loyalty of his investors would hold the company together. But the pace of the pressure grew faster than his confidence. The Boston Post prepared another major article. Reporters said they had uncovered evidence that Ponzi's past involved previous financial problems. They said these details raised serious questions. The managing editor pushed the newsroom to verify every detail before publication. When the article landed, it hit the city with force. People read it with disbelief. Investors lined up even faster the next morning. The question on their faces was sharp. They asked if Ponzi had lied to them. Inside the office, tension tightened like a rope. Clerks watched the cash reserves shrink as they paid out more withdrawals. They said nothing out loud. They moved faster. They stamped receipts and handed out envelopes. They wondered what would happen if the funds ran out before the day ended. Ponzi walked through the floor with the same calm expression, but his fingers trembled when he thought no one was looking. He met privately with advisors who told him the pressure was no longer sustainable. They warned him that regulators were closing in. He refused to accept it. He said the system would recover if the panic stopped. He believed he could release a statement that would reassure the public. The advisors exchanged uneasy looks. They feared the turning point was already behind them. Outside, the line continued to form before dawn. The conversations carried a new tone. People spoke about collapse. They pointed to newspaper articles. They said officials were preparing to examine Ponzi's books. They wondered if they would be the last ones to get their money back. A sense of urgency replaced the earlier excitement. Through it all, Ponzi kept moving forward. He greeted investors with a confident smile. He told the clerks to keep working. He signed documents with quick, sharp strokes. He said the company was strong. He said the critics were wrong. He tried to hold everything together through force of will. But the cracks were no longer subtle. They pushed through conversations, bank ledgers, and front-page articles. They showed up in the swelling lines outside the building. They strained the office staff who had stopped believing the system could last. They reached the desks of state officials who now prepared formal action. The pressure was tightening around him. The questions were getting louder. The structure that had looked unstoppable only weeks earlier now showed clear signs of instability. The next step would determine whether the company could survive another day or fall under the weight of its own promises. That question was no longer distant. It stood at the door, ready to break through. Chapter 3, The Unraveling. The pressure around 27 School Street tightened as July moved toward its end. The crowds no longer carried the same hopeful energy they once brought. People stood in line with stiff shoulders and folded arms. They spoke in low voices about audits, newspaper reports, and rumors of state action. The excitement that once defined the area had turned into something sharper. Each day carried the sense that a reckoning was coming. Inside the office, the clerks felt the shift more than anyone. They moved quickly between desks and tried to manage the rising wave of withdrawals. Their eyes followed the cash drawers with quiet fear. The reserves were shrinking faster than expected. They stamped receipts and passed envelopes across the counter. They hoped the day would end before the drawers emptied. They noticed Ponzi watching them more closely. They wondered if he realized how thin the line had become. Behind the scenes, the state banking commissioner prepared an official audit. Investigators arrived early one morning and asked to examine the company's records. They carried notebooks, ledgers, and sealed envelopes. Ponzi greeted them with a confident smile. He said he had nothing to hide. He walked them through the office and pointed to stacks of receipts. He said the system worked as long as people believed in it. The investigators listened, but focused on the numbers. They understood that belief alone could not produce profit. When the auditors examined the books, they found that the deposits reached millions. They traced the movement of money across accounts. They looked for evidence of coupon arbitrage. They found no significant records of coupon purchases. They found no shipments from foreign postal offices. They found nothing that supported Ponzi's explanation. The system appeared to be built entirely on investor money flowing in and out. They noted the shortfalls and marked figures on worksheets. The numbers told a story that no promise could cover. Word of the audit spread quickly through Boston. The Boston Post prepared another article, and people spoke about it before it even reached the presses. Investors lined up earlier than usual the next morning. Some pushed toward the doors, demanding their returns. Police stepped in to keep order. The tension in the air made the street feel smaller. People pressed receipts against their chests and said they needed answers. Inside the building, Ponzi walked through the office with a sharp gaze. He tried to project calm, but the strain showed in the lines around his eyes. When clerks whispered about the cash reserves running low, he told them to keep working. He insisted the audit would prove the system was sound. He said the newspapers had misled the public. He believed he could regain control with a single statement. But the numbers did not support his confidence. The auditors continued to dig. They calculated the scale of coupon purchases needed to sustain the promised returns. The figure they reached was staggering. One auditor said the company would need to handle tens of millions of coupons. Another said the entire global supply fell far short of that number. The audit revealed that the coupon trade had played no meaningful role in the company's operations. The structure depended entirely on new investments. The auditors exchanged quiet looks. They understood the implications. Officials prepared to take action. They studied the reports and concluded that the company faced massive shortfalls. They planned to seize records and prevent further withdrawals until the investigation was complete. They believed the system could collapse at any moment. They said the public needed to be protected. Ponzi faced a choice. He could fight the investigation and risk losing control, or he could cooperate and hope to negotiate better terms. He called advisors to his office and asked for guidance. Some urged him to comply. Others told him to resist. He listened to each voice but remained silent. He understood the pressure better than anyone. He knew the numbers were no longer in his favor. When federal agents arrived, Ponzi surrendered peacefully. He greeted them with the same polite tone he used in business meetings. He told them he trusted the system and believed the investigation would prove his innocence. They escorted him from the building as crowds gathered outside. People watched from the sidewalks as the man who once promised them financial freedom walked toward the federal building. Some shouted accusations. Others stood quietly, holding receipts that no longer mattered. The investigation moved quickly. Prosecutors reviewed the company's records and interviewed employees. They concluded that Ponzi had defrauded investors by promising returns he could not produce. The coupon trade, which he had described as the heart of the system, had almost no presence in the company's actual operations. The prosecutors prepared charges based on mail fraud, the legal tool often used to prosecute financial schemes that crossed state lines. Ponzi eventually entered a guilty plea. In court, he stood before the judge and admitted to the charges. He said he had never intended to harm anyone. He said he believed he could make the system work if given more time. The judge listened without comment. When the sentence was handed down, the courtroom fell silent. Ponzi received several years in federal prison. Investors watched the news with mixed emotions. Some felt relief, others felt betrayed. Many felt shame for trusting a promise that seemed too good to question. After serving his federal sentence, Ponzi faced state charges in Massachusetts. Those proceedings also ended in conviction. By the time he completed his time in custody, he was no longer the figure who once drew crowds to School Street. His influence had faded. The government deported him to Italy after determining he was no longer welcome in the United States. He spent his final years moving between small ventures and struggling to reclaim the power he once held. He never regained the status he believed he deserved. For the investors, the aftermath stretched for years. Some recovered small portions of their money. Many recovered nothing. Families who had trusted Ponzi with their savings faced new hardships. Men and women who once stood proudly in line outside his office now avoided talking about their involvement. They struggled with the weight of regret and embarrassment. Boston carried the memory of the collapse as a warning about unchecked trust. Financial experts studied the case and highlighted the lessons it taught. they explained the danger of relying on promises that defy economic logic. They emphasized the need for transparency and regulation. They said the collapse demonstrated how easily people could be drawn into a system fueled by hope rather than evidence. The term Ponzi scheme entered the vocabulary as a label for any financial structure that paid early investors with funds from newcomers instead of genuine profit. In the decades that followed, Ponzi's story became the blueprint for understanding similar schemes. His name carried a meaning he never intended. It represented illusion, manipulation, and the risks of believing in easy money. Economists and regulators referred to his case when examining new financial scandals. They said the core elements remained the same. They said human desire often overshadowed caution. Boston eventually moved forward, but the memory of the crowd outside 27 School Street lingered. People remembered the excitement, the hope, and the shock that followed. They remembered how a single promise could reshape a city's rhythm. They remembered how quickly that rhythm could collapse. In the end, the story of Charles Ponzi became more than a tale about a financial scheme. It became a lesson about trust, ambition, and the limits of persuasion. It became a reminder that systems built on belief rather than substance cannot survive long. It became a symbol of the cost of ignoring the numbers. What the case left behind shaped how future generations viewed financial opportunities. People learned to ask sharper questions. Regulators learned to examine operations more closely. The public learned that even the most confident promise could hide a fragile structure. The collapse answered the question that once pressed through the lines on School Street. It showed that the promise could not hold. It revealed the truth behind the carefully crafted image. And it left the world with a permanent warning carried in a single name.